Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Twin Ports are home to many talented writers. In the next hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 8th Annual Writers Read, and this year's theme is all about gut instinct. This year, around 20 writers were chosen to read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland on Friday, January 26th. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, Gut Instinct.
My name is Liz Manette, and I'm from Esko, Minnesota. And this is my poem called This Dying Company. This dying school supply company, we eat in its lunchroom, devouring yet another half-hour bologna and cheese Tupperware noodle break. A narrow space cluttered with tables and chairs, this lunchroom suspended between order processing and what this place once was. Salespeople's offices, large enough to park a small plane. Private bathrooms and cocktail lounges. Through the lunchroom's windows, we all watch the ice storm that's afternoon building and that we will not be let go early for. It's true, that happened too. Co-workers Pat and Francis have their faces at glass. They exclaim with all they can do is watch panic on the city bus sliding downward and sideways through a green light. After lunch, it's back to our cubicle maze and monotonous, sleepy click, key and punch orders. Chained to phone headsets, we all await the next upset teacher whose 5 reams of art paper rolls have wound up at another school across the state. Or the daycare provider who has received yet another dented and scratched play table and needs it picked up immediately, reordered, and reshipped immediately for no charge. An hour away from going home, Nancy comes and stands behind me without saying anything. She is staring out the window above my cubicle. Between phone orders, I turn around. Nancy apologizes, says she's just checking on their car, she and her husband's. She drove instead of taking the bus today. Our parking lot is lottery space, and she got the snake eyes, she says, her car parked where the lot tilts to the street. Cars have been known to domino on icy days, sliding, dinging, and scratching into and against each other until they can't. Multiple mini crashes without going anywhere. Starting with the vehicle at the top of the tilt where Nancy's car sits. Nancy's only got 5 more years of employment here or anywhere. She told some of us during one lunch break she nearly didn't get this job because of her age. Her husband, retired, waits at home for her. Both of them together, apart, crossing their fingers, nothing bad happens in these last 5 years. No extra expenses like parked, crashed cars. No slippery roadways home at 5 p.m. when Nancy, maybe all of us, should have taken the bus. Thank you.
My name is Marie Zwickoff, and I'm from Duluth. And the nonfiction story I'll be reading is called Book Signings Can Be Hazardous to Your Health. This is my security prop. It's the book that's mentioned in my story. Hold on to it. Jean Owl, author of prehistoric romances, sat behind a table in the downtown Minneapolis B. Dalton bookstore. With her mouth downturned, barely raising her eyes to the fans who presented her with copies of The Mammoth Hunters to sign, she looked like she'd rather be somewhere else, like she was only signing books because it was in her contract. As I stood in line with dozens of others that winter evening, clutching her book to my chest and awaiting my turn, I wondered at her demeanor. Why was she so sad? Why was it so hard for her to give her readers a bit of appreciation? It was the mid-1980s, and I was in college. I had written a few newspaper articles, but had yet to publish any novels. A book idea percolated in the back of my mind, however, and I imagined that if it were me behind that table one day, I'd be ecstatic to see such a long line of people awaiting the touch of my golden pen. Afterward, carrying my book with Jean Owl's desultory signature inside, I walked back to my car. I was vigilant, striding purposefully, just like the newscasts on crime prevention instructed. I had good reason. The last time I left my job late at the County Medical Center, I'd gotten robbed in the parking lot behind the Metrodome. That night, 2 months before, I had been outside, clearing the ice off the back window of my little blue Honda Accord. Between the noise of the engine and my scraping, I didn't hear the man approaching from behind until he passed and opened the driver's side door. He lifted my backpack off the front seat and started to walk away. "Hey," I yelled, stepping toward him. "What are you doing?" He wasn't tall. I figured I could take him in a fight. That's when he pulled out a knife from his army green parka.
"Don't try any funny stuff."
Yes, he actually said that. I pleaded with him to take my wallet and leave the rest. In the bag were the graduate school forms I had stayed late at work to finish typing, including my resume with all my personal information. The application postmark deadline was tomorrow. He ran off into the snowy night with my entire backpack and graduate school future firmly in hand. Weeping, I filed a report with a burly granite-faced policeman who kept telling me in a monotone to calm down. A week or so later, my wallet was found, sans money and extra car key. My grad school application was also missing. In the meantime, I had called the college and explained my plight. They allowed me more time to submit my application. Around that same time, I started to receive obscene phone calls, the man saying disgusting things about my body. I switched parking lots, but soon that proved too expensive on my students' wages. I returned to the lot behind the Metrodome, figuring that as long as I left work at 5 p.m. along with everyone else, I would be okay. The Jean Owl book signing lasted until 7 p.m. Upon reaching my car, I locked the doors as soon as I got in, as was my new habit. I started the engine and looked into the rearview mirror. A chill, colder than the Minnesota night, sliced my gut. A man was approaching, his face covered by a ski mask. He wore the same army parka as the man who robbed me, plus he had the same build. I clutched the car door handle, heart pounding. What if he remembered my car and he had my key with him? The man walked up to my car door. I couldn't see his eyes behind the mask. He jiggled the handle and, when it wouldn't open, kept walking nonchalantly. Relief flooded me. Then I got My car was running and I had a clear path to him. I revved the engine and took off. As the distance closed between us, the obscene phone calls, the stress of reapplying for grad school, the fear and the sadness all hit me. I wanted to run him down. I wanted to feel the impact, wanted to watch his body fly through the air and land broken in a snowbank. I was 12 feet away, 9 feet away, and he just kept walking with no break in stride. 7, 5 feet. I swerved and stopped. He just kept walking. I sat behind the wheel, shaking, watching the dark envelop his retreating back. I filed another police report, this time without weeping. Later, when a lieutenant visited my office carrying mugshots, I learned that another woman in the parking lot had been raped that night. With a mixture of relief and fury, I pointed to the mugshot of a short, blonde man. A few nights later, I learned that the cops arrested the man as he stalked the same lot. Eventually, there was a trial. Of the half dozen victims who filed reports, I was the only one who saw the man's face, so I was the star witness. Legs shaking, I walked past the robber on my way to the stand. As I testified, I stared straight at him, reveling as he fidgeted and squirmed in his chair. He got 5 years in Stillwater State Prison, and I got relief from worry about getting robbed every time I had to work late or wanted to attend a book signing. Even though 30 years has passed since these events, my hands tremble as I type this. It seems the least an author can do is smile and thank the admirers who come to their signings. After all, they can never know what their fans went through to get there, or what might happen to them afterwards.
Hi, my name is Maddie Cohen, and I, too, am from Duluth. I'm going to read some microfiction and then two Twitterature pieces. Peppermint. Sometimes I rise in the morning and wonder how I ended up with this family. I trek to the kitchen while my husband and kids are asleep. Even Sean, our youngest, who used to bolt downstairs at the crack of dawn because he couldn't stand the idea of missing out. And boil water for peppermint tea. I only make enough for myself. I live for this quiet time. We're in a sleepy Midwestern suburb where there's no pulse until 8 or 9. Maybe I'll brew a pot of dark roast instead of tea to get my brain going. I decide I don't want to get my brain going and stick with the tea. The peppermint soothes me. I sit by the window while the bag steeps in my mug, warming my hands as I watch the elms poke through the mist outside. I take a sip of the steaming liquid, and there's a zip, the spice of the peppermint I'm not quite ready for. 14 years ago, I met my husband. He was a painter then, but he doesn't paint anymore. Now he's an accountant. While I'm grateful he does our and others' taxes so flawlessly, I don't think I'd have married him knowing what we, would become. It's the only thing that gets me out of my head, he used to say about his painting. Back then, I wanted so much to get inside his head. Today, I don't know what I want. I've downed my tea, but I can't bring myself to get up from this chair. I've buried my body in the buttery leather. This chair cocoons me, massaging my back. I could have brewed coffee, but I wanted tea. I could pack a bag and leave this house, but I think I'll stay. And now, some Twitterature. The last one, Predator. They say to back away slowly from a bear. I bolted down the path, screaming. Thank you.
I'm Felicia Schneider-Hahn, and this is a prologue to a novel in progress called On Belay. We emerged from the crevasse to find the world was still completely white. No depth, no orientation, a featureless landscape. We were blind. It was impossible to see the Alaskan range cresting up beneath us, or that we stood 15,000 feet above sea level. It was impossible to see my husband Paul standing 2 feet in front of me, or our 3 team members following me out of the crevasse. It was impossible to see what to do next. We had been on Mount Foraker for 10 days. It took 5 days to ascend the infinite spur, the hardest route I had ever climbed, the best climbing I had ever done. At the summit, we took the obligatory photos and started down. A few hours later, the mother of all blizzards descended upon us. We found refuge in a crevasse to wait out the storm. We had been waiting in that crevasse for 5 days. And now we had 2 days of food and fuel left. In clear weather, that was just enough to make it down the Sultana Ridge and back to base camp. If we ran out of food, we could garner enough energy to make it a few more days. But without fuel to light the jet boil and melt snow to drink, we were dead. Before we set out, we had cached 2 fuel canisters and some energy bars in a crevasse at 8,000 feet. If we could make it there, we'd have a better shot at reaching base camp. But it meant descending 4,000 feet in a whiteout. There was no way to communicate with base camp. Our sat phone could not connect. We struggled to make a decision without enough information. Should we continue to wait out the storm or try to find our way down? The lenticular clouds circled us like a tornado. It was loud as a jet engine. The wind pummeled us, threatening to carry us right off. We huddled together so we could see and hear each other. After so many days of close quarters, our 5 bodies had become one. Paul's eyebrows and eyelashes looked like the heavy, snow-packed boughs of an evergreen. His beard caked with ice, snot ran from his nose. "We need to go," he yelled, his breath rancid. Jeff answered him, with his hand tucked safely into his coat. "We can't see, it's suicide." A week earlier, as we meticulously made our way up the knife's edge under bluebird skies, Jeff had dropped his mitt. He watched helplessly as it drifted thousands of feet down into an abyss of rock and ice, a simple mistake. We were all wearing a double layer of gloves and mitts. With our 50-pound packs, no one had wanted the weight of even one pair of extra mitts. In a crevasse, Jeff could protect his hand with only a glove. If we tried to descend in a blizzard, breaking trail through deep snow, a glove would not be enough. He might lose fingers or his whole hand. Carrie's blue eyes were bright and determined. "I'm not dying up here," she said. "I'll die coming down." Her mentor had disappeared on the first all-female ascent of the Infinite Spur 6 years earlier. Rescuers deduced the women summited, met a storm just like this, and dug in to wait it out. They never reemerged. "I know this route," Paul told Jeff. "Even in this storm, trust me, I can get us down." "You're wrong," Jeff said. "I'm not dying for your ego. I'm staying here." Paul looked at me. I could see it in his eyes. Everything waiting for us in Minnesota, our 2 sons, our family, our friends. "What do you think, Hannah?" For 5 days, I'd been fighting every urge in me to go. On the first day of the storm, I had wanted to stay on course and keep working our way down, but I was the least experienced climber on the team, and I set aside my impulse for the team's decision to stay put. Now we were at the impasse. Did I trust Paul to know the route well enough to keep us on it, even in 4 feet of fresh snow with no visible landmarks? Or the bigger question, did I have it in me to leave somebody behind? Thank you.
You're listening to Writers Read, Gut Instinct, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by writers living in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. We'll take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's pledge drive time at Wisconsin Public Radio. We won't interrupt Hear Me Out other than for these few seconds to ask for your support for this public radio station. You count on WPR to make a difference in your day, to inform and entertain you. Support radio that stimulates your mind. Support your public radio station, and you will make a difference. At WPR.org or at 888-202-2552, and you and we will be glad that you did.
Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Twin Ports are home to many talented writers, In the next hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 8th annual Writers Read, and this year's theme is all about gut instinct. This year, around 20 writers were chosen to read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland on Friday, January 26th. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, Gut Instinct.
Hey everybody, my name is Bronte Gross. This is my third Writer's Read, and my piece is entitled, Oops in Sloops. Okay, I yelled across the heads of the milling children. The wind looks decent, so hop into your boats and let's go sailing! I enunciated each word with the perfect confidence of someone who has absolutely no idea what they're doing. And then I hopped into my motorized dinghy and puttered out to one of the worst decisions I have ever made. I was teaching a class of children how to sail on the biggest lake by surface area in the world. We were beached next to Bodine's Fishery in Bayfield, and if you twisted your head just right, you could smell the raw power of the open lake hiding just a few islands away. It was my first summer of teaching, and today we had 10 8 to 12-year-old sailors and 3 teenage ones. The little ones had 8-foot boats, and the older ones were in 14-foot sloops. This distinction didn't really matter, because none of them had the foggiest idea of what they were doing. It was day 2 in their learning to sail adventure, and after hours of instruction on knots theory and how to equip themselves with a life jacket and a wetsuit, they had almost mastered each other's names. My task then was to safely teach them how to sail in an easy and comforting manner. And the particular thing today to decide was, is it too windy to sail? I had spent several long minutes agonizing over this, watching the gusts rush across the water. Ah, well, the kids would figure it out. I drifted slowly out by the course I had set and watched the children pile into their boats. Everyone was anxious to be going, jockeying along the shoreline, dangling half in and half out of their vessels, and then, all of a sudden, they were off. I peered at them. Gee, they were going fast. Should they be going that fast? One of the kids shot past me, screaming, his white-knuckled grip fastening him to his boat. He slammed the tiller over, and the boat pivoted like the ballerina in a music box. Off he went, screaming in the other direction, and that was when the rest of the kids arrived. For a second, there was a brief, floating feeling that one gets at the edge of chaos. And in the corner of my eye, I saw that far off in the distance, the larger boats had already capsized, spilling the students into the water. I ignored the burgeoning riot around me to watch them as, yep, the boats turtled, the masts sinking slowly as the smooth hulls pivoted to the surface of the water. Most of the Opti kids were trapped in what can only be called the death spiral. Scared, they had dropped their tiller and their main sheet, totally losing control. Left to its own devices in the high wind, their boat spun in rapid circles, a clothes washer on spin cycle. Kid collapsed inside the cold fiberglass bottom, waiting for the world to end. The boom crashed across each boat every time they crossed the wind line, flogging the sail and adding to the general cacophony of noise. Oh boy. I blew my whistle 3 times, the signal to send everyone back to shore. Nothing happened. Calm did not overtake calamity, as I had wistfully expected. Well, only one thing left to do. I pulled the ripcord and my motor roared in eagerness. I zipped over and hauled the nearest kid into my boat, swiftly yanked the mast off, and tied the boat onto my tow line, dragging the whole assemblage back to shore. And then back out, Soon, the work blurred like any other repetitive task. Grab the kid, dismast the boat, tie the knot. I worked all-out triage for 30 minutes, but finally, after an interminable amount of spray and tears, there was only one boat left. One of the larger sloops, still upside down in the water. The kids had been evacuated off it already, and for the final mission, I chose the two most senior instructors, Will and Laura. We stepped into the dinghy, three avenging angels out on one last-ditch journey. The spray was building, thrashing off the bow as we thundered out to the lonely hull. I passed the driving off to Laura, and Will and I jumped into the lake, swiftly righting the small sloop and de-rigging the sails. Laura brought the boat around, and we hopped aboard, tying it off, and finally relaxed. No harm done. With a quick yank on the ripcord, the engine rumbled us towards home, the winds screaming and the waves thumping across the bay. A siren sounded from the shore. From across the grumbling lake, we could see the orange bow of the Coast Guard cutter emerging from its grotto. We puttered along, maintaining our speed and heading as they pulled up alongside. One of the coasties leaned outside of the cabin. "Hey." "Hi," I replied, the whipping spray giving me a drink as I talked. "So," he said, "you guys need any help?" The statement hung in the air as I looked around. "You know, I think we got it." His head ducked into the cabin, held a brief discussion, and then popped back out. "Well, we're going to follow you in, back in and make sure everything is good." "Okay." He retreated to the cabin and shut the door. Laura gunned the motor, and we inched along back to shore. When I stepped foot on land, the first thing I did was take a deep breath. My stomach untwisted, my countenance eased, and I bathed in the warm glow of a day not too f***ed up. The kids were running around and screaming, in a good way this time, and the boats were safely on land. Two orange dots separated from the Coast Guard station and began walking over to our beach. I was wary, but maybe they were just coming over to check a few boxes off a form. After all, we hadn't done anything wrong, had we? I felt pride jumping in my chest. The instructors and I had done a great thing out there. Sure, I had made the horrible decision and caused it in the first place, but when shit hits the fan, the only thing to do is clean it up. The coasties walked up and smiled. "Hey, we couldn't help but notice out there, none of your boats are properly registered." And they handed me the ticket.
Another tough act to follow. I'm Joel Glickman. This is my second writer's read. I'm so happy to be here. My poem is a genesis for Small Fish, but the epigraph that starts it is a short quote from the New Testament. A genesis for Small Fish. "And Jesus went into the temple of God and cast out all them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves." King James Bible, Matthew 21:12. "And I know nothing of what happened to the doves, whether they languished there or Jesus let them go, but I know that all the coins from off the tables rolled down into the sea but did not sink, instead becoming all the smaller fishes, not the whales or any of the deep leviathans, but just the ones I've chased through life across the outback of a late and strange and Christian-era dream time. No longer are they busts of Titus and such tyrants stamped upon the ancient dinars and the drachmas, but yellow perch and brim and red-eared sunfish and green sunfish and rusty pumpkin seeds. I know who you are, each one, and you know me. Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, Aborigine, throwbacks all. gone on walkabout with hook and line. The old man sitting by us on the train from Chicago, going down to Mississippi for the bluegills in mid-May. And then our grown child and his young child in Minnesota, on a river ripe with summer, catching crappies. While I am near home in a small boat, and I hear above the waves lapping on the hull, and above the creaking of the oars, the song that comes singing out of the water from the mouths suspended there, giving themselves unwitting to the bait and pan. And their sweetness on my tongue is like religion, and I hear cooing as Jesus feeds his pigeons. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Emily Loker, and I'm very honored to follow my former classmates, Joel and Bronte. The following story really happened. Bobby the Goat. Bobby lay on his side, his legs kicking, as though desperately running but going nowhere. My boss, a fellow intern, and I gathered around the helpless animal. Me with tears streaming down my cheeks, the other two looking on with arms crossed like it was just another day at the inn. I gazed deep into Bobby's brown goat eyes. His lush eyelashes batted furiously in tandem with his legs. After 15 minutes, Bobby was dead. I watched as my boss and coworker wrapped him unceremoniously in a plastic tarp and took him to the garden where they buried him. Bobby had become sick just weeks after I had arrived at the inn on an idyllic Maine island bed and breakfast, where I had come to spend the summer tending the garden and working in the inn's restaurant. But the joyful task of feeding the three goats had turned into an emotional test of will as I witnessed Bobby banging his head repeatedly on the barn door and stumbling around in circles. At night, I could hear his human-like cries, a murderous scream from my garden shed accommodation that drowned out even the chorus of crickets and frogs. The vet only said it appeared he had some sort of neurological disease, and with no conclusive diagnosis, offered to come euthanize him if he appeared to be getting worse. In the weeks following Bobby's death, I would wake up hearing Bobby's endless cries. Images of him wobbling around his pen echoed in my mind as I weeded the garden in the early morning. He was buried, but I could not let him go, not without finding out what had happened to him. So I began a haphazard search for answers. I talked to the vet, nothing. I then turned to the only other source of information I could think of at the time, the internet. A simple search of goat neurological disorders produced a litany of deadly diseases. Acid-base derangement, grassy tetany, hypocalcemia, listeriosis, pituitary abscess, and of course, rabies. Since I was only familiar with rabies, I proceeded to satiate my hypochondria-fueled confirmation bias by limiting any further research exclusively to the virus, and it did not look good. Bobby's unexplained illness closely mirrored its symptoms: excessive salivation, bleeding, and repeated actions. Once an animal, humans included, displayed any symptoms, it was already too late for treatment. Death was imminent. Although the vet had ruled out rabies, saying his symptoms weren't consistent with the virus, I could not be consoled by her dismissal, not when experts in cyberspace so clearly disagreed. So I became fixated on the possibility that I had contracted rabies from feeding Bobby with my blistered hands. The simple task that made up my day, weeding and watering the garden, preparing desserts and salad for meal service, doing the dishes, provided ample time for my mind to oscillate between the extremes: imminent death in a matter of months or years, and recognizing the sheer improbability of rabies even having entered the equation at all. Nevertheless, I felt my hands tingle as I envisioned the virus entering through the sores on my palms and spreading through my body, eventually taking over my central nervous system and leading to my death. After weeks of waking up multiple times a night, fearing I was symptomatic, I decided I needed to know for sure that I did not have this deadly virus. I told my boss, who agreed to allow me to take time off work, leave the island, and see a doctor. I thanked her profusely, already feeling a wave of relief. The staff at the clinic assured me I had been justified in seeking treatment, a course of 3 vaccinations spread over 3 weeks, and added that they would be reporting the possible exposure to the Centers for Disease Control. My cheeks went flush. I already felt I had been enough of an imposition on the inn for taking time off work to seek treatment for an undiagnosable disease, and I wanted nothing more at that time than to forget the entire ordeal. Despite my wishes, there was simply no way around involving the CDC. Rules are rules. Days later, I was told that the CDC had called the inn. I was waitressing. The innkeeper, a British woman who tended to yell at her employees even when guests could hear her, let me have it while I balanced a hot plate of local roasted haddock. She had spoken with the CDC that morning and apparently was none too pleased with the conversation. Emily, she said sharply, it seems you are going to have to dig up your beloved goat. I cowered in shame and turned to leave, just as my boss, the innkeeper's daughter, entered into the kitchen. My eyes pleaded with her to reason with her mother. But Mom, she can't dig up the goat tomorrow, I lifted slightly. She has to help me build the earthen oven, she finished. I went about the rest of dinner service in a haze, failing to distract my mind from the image of Bobby's partially decomposed body. Rabies can only be diagnosed definitively by extracting brain tissue. And because the inn is a relatively public place, the CDC wanted to make really sure and take a sample from Bobby to determine if he had indeed had the virus. I spent that sunny mid-July weekend ankle deep in cob, clay, and concrete, baking in my anxiety about exhuming Bobby's body as I mixed heavy ingredients to make the pizza oven. But the cool Monday morning brought good news. After speaking with the vet in me, the CDC had decided that Bobby had not had significant enough interaction with the public to warrant further investigation. Bobby would continue to rest in peace, and I could continue to live my life rabies-free. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Writers Read, Gut Instinct, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by writers living in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. We'll take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio.
You've made it a habit of listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Now make it a habit of donating. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thanks.
Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Twin Ports are home to many talented writers. In the next hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 8th annual Writers Read, and this year's theme is all about gut instinct. This year, around 20 writers were chosen to read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland on Friday, January 26th. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, Gut Instinct.
My name is Isabel Jacobson. This poem is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Cats. My son runs around the house screaming, My daughter poops into a box. And when she is done pooping into the box, she covers it up with her soft little hands, and I tell her she's perfect. I call her my sweet pea. I call her my princess. I call her fluff baby, fluffy floof, floofy fluff. Sometimes I call her Persula or Fursula because, of course, I didn't name her after my grandmother. That would be weird. I named her after who I wish my grandmother was, the grand matriarch of all literary cat ladies, the late great Ms. Ursula K. Le Guin, who would have had a lot to say on this topic, who would ask why it's always cat ladies we talk about, sad, crazy ladies who couldn't have babies, old crazy ladies who lost all their babies, proud crazy ladies who refuse to have babies and never regret it for a second, no matter what anyone says. Because how could you? You'd have to really be crazy to actually want to bring a human child into this world. I mean, have you seen the world lately? Our instincts weren't made for this world. Now, don't blame the ovaries. Don't blame the estrogen. I have seen a man. It was that man right there. I have seen a man fall so deeply, so quickly, so totally in love with a rescue cat, we cracked jokes about mind control parasites. But toxoplasmosis gets way too much credit. Evolution gave cats their big eyes and big ears, chubby small bodies and soft heart-shaped faces. Made them each weigh about 8 pounds, 7 ounces. Taught them to vibrate at the precise frequency we find soothing and cry at the precise frequency we can't ignore. It's mind control. But only in the sense that any love is mind control. So I will not bear you a child, but I will bear you a cat. I will pick it up and bear it in my arms and set it down on top of you. And when the first cat stands up and walks away, I will do it again. I will cover you in a clowder of cats, because that is how you and I express our love, all the love we can afford, a love that's small enough to bear. The relationship is much simpler for the cats. A cat wants what it wants, to climb trees, to climb furniture, to catch a mouse, to catch a fake mouse, to catch a bug, to catch a hand, to catch a bird, or a fake bird, a paperclip, a ping pong ball, a shoelace, a used Kleenex, a half-eaten sandwich, or the tip of its own tail, to eat the thing it caught, and then to curl up in a warm lap or a warm hole in the ground. It doesn't matter. Most indoor cats don't feel conflicted about it. Still, I think they understand our frustrated instincts a little bit. Or at least, I like to pretend they do. When my cat's tearing up and down the stairs at top speed at 3 a.m, yelling at the top of his lungs with all his claws out and his pupils as big as dinner plates, and I look at him and I say, "Me too, buddy. Me too." Thank you.
I'm Lori Otis, and I'm from Washburn, Wisconsin. And I haven't been in the writer's read for a couple years, but I was in for about 6 times, I think, and I've enjoyed it so much over the years. I'm going to read a story that I wrote. I don't know which writer's read it was in, but it was several years ago. And I thought maybe I'd start off with a little Shakespeare, since that seems to be the thing to do tonight. It's from A Midsummer Night's Dream. And sleep, that sometimes shuts up sorrow's eye, steal me a while from mine own company. My piece tonight is called A Spring Night's Dream. We were in the kitchen, seemingly engrossed in wrapping leftovers in sheets of plastic. I concentrated on categorizing in my mind which containers were slated for the refrigerator and which were for the freezer. I imagined scenarios when it might come in handy to just pull a meal out of the freezer at the last minute. I kept the planning foremost in my mind, saving all other thoughts to draw on another time when everyone was gone and I was truly alone. Time enough then to feel the emptiness of the house and to hear for the first time the clock ticking. Time enough then to remember the 43 years of our life together. Time enough to wonder what to do with the rest of my life. Time enough to finally cry. "Look at all this food," I said. Aside from what we had prepared that morning, there were all these dishes that friends and neighbors had left. "Sorry for your loss," they'd mumbled awkwardly as they handed me a casserole and a card that would surely contain a nominal sum of money. Strange thing, the ritual of the modern death. I know in other cultures, grievers are allowed to wail and cry and throw themselves on the casket, but neither my Midwest Scandinavian genes nor those of my neighbors would ever permit such a display. There seems to be some sort of taboo about mentioning the deceased's name. I've uttered the same cliche as I've pressed covered dish into waiting hands. "Please don't cry," I'd think to myself, because I'd be embarrassed. "Okay," I'd say, "keep the conversation light and general in nature. Leave the cover off when you put it in the oven." And then I'd launch into some weather comments. "But be sure you don't say it's a beautiful sunny day, because that would mean nice day for a funeral." I suddenly remembered the mentally challenged grown son of a friend who, when his father died, stood by the casket, tears rolling unashamedly down his cheeks. Like a loyal dog defending his fallen master, he kept repeating, "God damn, too bad about Joe." Everyone shushed him and tried to get him to move, and it occurred to me that he was the only one in the room who made any sense. My reverie was suddenly shattered as one of my daughters said, "Was Dad ever romantic, Mother?" Her voice seemed too loud in that quiet aggregation, and I struggled to shift my thoughts to this astounding new topic. So I decided to be humorous. "I guess he was. We had four children." I laughed, and all the room nervously produced a slight chuckle and busied themselves with the foil and plastic containers, pressing, pinching, folding. "That was just sex. Was he ever romantic?" she said. Alone that night, I sat in my recliner and I elevated my tired feet. It had been a long, difficult day, but I had managed to pull it off in the manner that was expected of me. No dramatics, put everyone at ease, make sure everyone's presence was properly acknowledged, and that they were thanked, hugged, and promised to call if I thought I needed anything. I looked at the empty recliner a few feet from mine, expecting to see him there, his feet up, ready to exchange comments on how the day had gone. Then my daughter's question suddenly popped into my head, and I leaned back, pleased at having to concentrate on something besides his absence and all the uncertainties that that presented. I closed my eyes, and I began to recall. It was May of our freshman year in Northland College. Aside from the agonies of dealing with homesickness, adjusting to classes, and getting along with roommates and new friends, it had been a very harsh winter. Fierce storms had arrived early in the fall and continued through to early spring, making living difficult even for us dorm girls who only had to make our way across campus. Then miraculously, the thawing rains came early and the snowbanks morphed into rivers, rushing onslaught through every crevice and ditch in what seemed like a frantic effort to reach Lake Superior. The sun shone brightly and the land came alive with budding foliage and early flowers. We'd all forgotten about the violets, mayflowers. The Memorial Hall girls craved the sun like pale yellow, light-deprived plants, and moved their notebooks and texts outside to study for the first final exams. It was 1951, and we didn't know that too much sun could cause cancer and definitely wrinkles. Those lucky enough to tan pursued the condition religiously, and even we fair-skinned and scared sisters slathered on the baby oil just tinged with iodine and stretched our bodies like drying pelts during the hours of strongest sunlight. I wince as I remember some of the resulting painful burns. But you know, although it was painful, we preferred the rosy glow of damaged skin to our fish belly look. We discovered a low building behind the dorm that had a flat metal roof and a permanent ladder leaning against one side. It was perfect. Not only would the metal reflect more sunlight, but the rooftop would provide the necessary privacy for exposing more delicate parts of the body and for conducting personal discussions outside the earshot of unwelcome visitors. "Sweet dreams of you," sang Patsy Cline from Mary's portable radio as a large group of us lay arranged like hot dogs on a grill. So we were trying to take full advantage of the more popular noontime hours. "Are you going out with him again?" "Well, if he asks me." Along with the miracle of spring came a possible love interest after a winter that was, for me, as harsh in the area of romance as it was in weather. "Well, do you like him?" "Well, sure, I don't know him. I just know him from French class. He's funny, and he's really nice. In fact, he's a music major. In fact, he's singing in the spring recital tonight." "Well, you're going, aren't you?" "Oh, do you think I should? Won't it seem too forward?" It was a different time, you know. "I don't even know if I like him that much." "Well, you're such a drip. That would be like a geek or a nerd. You know, you have to encourage men, you know." Everybody agreed with a nod as we all made one turn to the right to accommodate the moving sun. "But I don't want him to think I'm chasing him." "Well, what if we all go together? He won't know who we came to see. We'll just be on an evening out in cross campus." Everyone agreed with a nod as we again turned, this time to accommodate someone stretching out a leg cramp. "Look at all the lilacs," somebody said. "Bushes behind the building were green-leafed last fall and barren all winter had suddenly become laden with heavy and conical-shaped full bunches of grapes, full bunches of lilacs. They were beautiful, and the smell was intoxicating. Before going inside, slightly dazed and disoriented from the light and the heat, we gathered bouquets of the lavender beauties, bringing the spring inside to adorn our stuffy dorm rooms. As I recall, I spent the rest of the afternoon like a sleepwalker, slow of motion, lazy, avoiding serious thought. It was spring, and life flowed through me like a warming liquid on a cold day, first heating the core of my body, then seeping slowly into the extremities until I felt as if I could curl my fingers and hold my future as I would hold a cup to keep it from spilling out. Winter was done, and anything was possible. After we'd showered and lotioned, curled and perfumed in preparation for the recital, We snipped sprigs of lilacs to pin in our hair or wear in our buttonholes. Some even made small nosegays with ribbon streamers to carry. I thought it a little something out of Midsummer Night's Dream as our giddy group trooped across campus to Wheeler Hall. A little intoxicated with the warm night and the flowers and the anticipation of romance. At the door of the recital room, a professor's wife stood with her three little girls, dressed in their best and excited about going to an adult event. We stopped as one and pinned lilacs in their hair or pressed a sprig in their hands to carry. And as we entered the room, I could almost see our moods spread like mist over those already seated as they smiled and pointed at our flower-bedecked group. Suddenly, we were all friends in the possibilities of spring and the magic of the evening. I remember little about the music I heard that night until the last piece. The boy I barely knew, but who would become my husband for 43 years, turned to look directly at me and sang flawlessly a musical rendition of an ancient Ben Jonson poem. Drink to me only with thine eyes, and I will pledge with mine. Or leave a kiss within the cup, and I'll not look for wine. I was aware of faces turning to look and of gentle proddings from my female friends, as if I hadn't noticed what was happening. But his eyes kept mine, and whether it was the spring, the public declaration, the smell of lilacs, or maybe Shakespeare's mythical Puck was truly abroad dispensing his infamous potion. But I fell in love that night, and though sorely pressed at times, I never fell out of love with that boy. I awakened with a start. I realized that the emotional drain of the day had caused me to slip into sleep when I had just meant to close my eyes and remember. Was it just a dream of something that I wished had happened? But now fully awake and with open eyes, I heard again his voice. I smelled the lilacs, and I felt the warm spring breeze from the open window. I'd almost forgotten it over the years of mundane worries and triumphs of life. But now that I have it again, it will become my fondest memory. I'm sure there were other romantic moments throughout the course of our time together, but in life, the first of anything is always the sweetest. Thank you.
You've been listening to the 8th Annual Writer's Read, Gut Instinct, featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, literature, and poetry from writers living in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. Our thanks to readers Jeanette Christie, Molly Hoag, Rob Ganson, Beth Palma, Nancy Larson, Kyle Anholt, Carol Dunbar, Avisa Rockwell, Ella Shively, Lucy Amundsen, Liz Minette, Marie Zwickoff, Maddie Cohen, Felicia Schneiderhan, Bronte Gross, Joel Glickman, Emily Loker, Isabel Jacobson, and Lori Otis. You can hear this program again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, enjoy the weekend.